This presentation is about ordained women in ministry, one story, which means mine. However, we're lucky that we have some other women here in the room who are ordained, and so they may want to contribute, and you may want to ask questions that would go to any of us. The first time I ever stood in a pulpit, I was 19 years old, and I was at the church, at a church called Mount Olivet, where I was then a member. I must have been about a sophomore in college. And typically on Sunday nights, we had an evening event called Fellowship for All, which began with a short worship service and was followed for the teens, anyway, with activities. And we're talking now a bit of big church, so there would be a lot of people at that worship service, a couple hundred people. And the deaconess, parish deaconess, asked me if I would please give the meditation for that night. Different people did. And I said, fine. And I talked then about my experience with my mother having died just the year before and how that affected my faith. There was no way on that evening. By the way, I enjoyed it. I thought it was great. I had a lot of fun doing that. I mean, we had this little button that you pushed and the lights all dimmed, you know. The spot came up. It was kind of grandiose. But I enjoyed it. It seemed very comfortable to me. But there was no way in the world I could have imagined that 26 years later I would be standing in that pulpit, that same pulpit, preaching my first sermon to a big group of people on Sunday morning. In the days when I was in college and high school, it was not possible, of course, for a woman to be ordained. I don't think in any denomination at that stage. It was 1970 before we began to ordain Lutheran women, and we will celebrate then 20 years next year of Lutheran women being ordained. We're all going to go to California, I hope, and celebrate that together. In the meantime, I did what a lot of people did. I found other things to do. If I were to go back to my very early childhood, I was pretty much a member of a church all the time, but we moved a lot. Every couple of years, my family moved, and so there were a lot of different churches. Most of them were Lutheran. One, I remember, was probably not Lutheran, and it was a church in which they sang Heavenly Sunshine a lot. Do you remember that little song? And climb, climb up Sunshine Mountain. It was, and I didn't identify too well with that stuff, and I was seven at the time. But there was something about that place that I didn't like so well. And I think it was, in retrospect, the fact that I could tell that I was sort of judged when I didn't come. Here we go. We have a guest coming in just now, a little bit later, so we want to get her settled, because it's hard for her to see the signer. We're talking about when I was a girl and how I felt in church. I could tell when I'd been missing the week before that rather than feeling welcomed back, I was sort of being scolded for having been gone. You'll have to come over here, I think. We've got one more. And that didn't feel so comfortable to me. It was sort of hard for my family always to get me to church. Largely, my mom was responsible for our family, and my dad seldom home, and not very interested in church. So there were a lot of times when I missed. But I kind of liked it, basically. And my childhood was really deranged enough, in a sense. I was in a very, very dysfunctional family that I had a lot of questions from the time I had questions when I was, I'm sure, 3 years old about God and whether or not this is the way life is supposed to be and why things were the way they were. And there wasn't anybody who could tell me that climb, climb up Sunshine Mountain was what life was all about, because I knew better, even when I was small. When I was in high school, I probably had the same natural questions that a lot of people did, maybe more, because I always asked them. And when I was in college, I met my first non-believers, which was a little shaky for me, wondered about that. But of course, I was being advised to do one of the things that women did then. We're talking about the late 50s and early 60s. I was either going to be a nurse, wasn't I? A nurse or a teacher or a mother. I remember writing on a kind of a sheet when you went to the University of, this is Minnesota, what do you want to be doing in 10 years from now? And I sort of just sighed and thought, 27, I suppose I'll be a mother. And there was sort of a resignation that that's all that it would be. So you can tell the kind of ideas I had about being at home, which weren't very positive, were they? And considering there were times when one, really, when that was one of the things most of us did. When I graduated in 1961 from college, indeed, I was not about to get married like a lot of the girls were doing, and I was going to teach school. I had been advised not to try to teach social studies and political science because that's what the coaches taught, and I would never get a job. And of course, it was true. She said, my counselor said, why don't you teach English? And I said, because I don't like English. Well, maybe elementary would be best then. And that's, in fact, what I did. I taught elementary school for 4 years. But I met a friend who said, I want you to meet my brother. Right now he's studying in Scotland. And when he comes home, you've just got to meet him. And I did. And he was a seminary student. And I could get close to what I wanted to do. Now, none of that was conscious, none of it. He also was a lot of fun, and we did talk about lots of interesting things, and particularly social issues. We were both concerned about the church in the world very much. We had a lot in common in that respect. But in retrospect, I would say that I saw myself as the pastor's wife. I had long ago eliminated being a missionary. My family had said, oh, it's too hard. And being a parish worker really didn't fit for me. And being a secretary, I knew was out of the question. I would never be able to type. By the way, I remember in about sixth grade, I had a very important Sunday school teacher. And I said to her once, it says in the fourth commandment that you're supposed to honor your father and mother. But what if your father and mother aren't good people? Or whatever a sixth grader might ask. You know, I have no idea what that woman answered, but I do know that she gave me a sense of it's okay to ask the question. It was that was heresy, you know. That was from a little girl. That was kind of a daring question. Thank goodness Violet Larson, I've come to know her name later, had the good sense to just let me ask the question. I married John then 1 year after I graduated from college. And you all know Ted. He was born 4 years later. And juggles for fun. And it was an interesting thing being a pastor's wife. For one thing, I had a lot of fears about it. And I voiced a lot of those prior because I said, I don't believe all this stuff, for one thing. And John said, it's all right. Don't worry about it. And I used to say when the children were younger, gee, I wish I knew more about the Bible. I don't know anything about it. Maybe I should go to LBI, Lutheran Bible Institute. And John would say, no, really, that wouldn't be enough for you. You'd have to go to seminary and take some classes. Well, I never did that. And I went back into teaching and worked part-time and so on. And as many of you already know, when I was about 40, I was divorced. That had been coming for a long, long time. And it was a very painful decision for both John and me. By then, I was working in the church and in a pretty nice position. The senior pastor at the church where I went to work, we called me director of social ministries. So does social ministry identify with all of you? Do you know what I'm talking about? Community concerns, reaching out into the world and the neighborhood, that kind of stuff. I loved it. And I was also doing stewardship and communications in that church. And occasionally that pastor would let me preach. And I loved that. I usually went too long, he said. I couldn't help it. It was sort of like 17 to 20 minutes a lot of times. And Ted would say, you know, you got to keep it 17 and under. You got to do that. And so I tried. But John and I could not make that marriage work. And at the age of about 41 then, we separated. A very painful decision for anybody who's involved in ministry in the way we were. And I can remember telling the church council that night, I was so nervous, I just literally kind of shook inside me, which isn't typical for me in front of a group. But I was scared to tell them that that's what was happening in our home, but they were very good. And those who I feared the most, rejection from the most, were the ones who came over and gave me a hug. It was wonderful. And twice in any of the time that I continued to work at that church did I feel any rejection by that church for my choice in terms of marriage. If they were saying things about that divorce, they were not saying it in such a way that it ever got back to me. I thought they were very caring. But that was a new place for me then. And it was April that we separated, and Pentecost came in June, and I happened to preach on Pentecost. And you know, it was one of those super services where the music was just right and the air was just electric. And the sermon went fine. And I loved doing it. It probably could have bombed. I would have loved it. I don't know. And I sat down next to Ted, the senior pastor, and I was thinking, because over the last 6 weeks prior, maybe even a little longer, people had said to me several times, you know, you ought to be a pastor. And I thought, gee, it's funny that so many people are saying that all at the same time. And I sat down after preaching and I said, Ted, you know, I think I've got to go to seminary. And he didn't say much because the service was going on. And the next morning, Ted showed up in my office and he said, were you serious about going to seminary? And I said, I don't know. And he said, I think you ought to do it. So I investigated what was required to become a certified professional. After all, I had some career choices to make now, too. And those things were all okay, but none of them quite fit. I didn't want to just stick with education, for example, or music. I couldn't have done that, and so on. I needed something that was broader, and I realized that I needed a place where I could ask the same kind of questions I used to ask Violet Larson. I needed to pursue this kind of searching faith that I've always had. I'm always probably going to be one of those people who doubts and believes. I've given up on myself coming to any firm conclusions. It doesn't work for me. Just when I think I've got it in place, something moves, you know. And so I went to seminary, and indeed I could ask the questions I needed to ask, and the people didn't turn white with fear, and they helped me think it through, work it through. And the longer I was there, the better I felt. And in fact, the longer I was there, the more I was convinced I was a forgiven person. Interesting. When you're on a pass-fail system, it's easier than if you were getting A's and B's and so on, I suppose. But I did feel like a forgiven person. And of course, I came to know more, I would say more, about the Bible and that sort of thing. But more than that, I knew more about the struggle. I want to mention that not too long before that, I had gone to a professional leadership retreat. And I remember the day, the evening, so well, when we had Eucharist, and the person who was celebrating was a woman. In fact, she has been at one time here at Holden as the pastor. And I can remember the moment when she said, this is the body of Christ broken for you. And she presided, and afterwards she said, the body and blood of our Lord Jesus Christ strengthen you and keep you in his grace. It was the first time that a woman had ever given me absolution. And it suddenly struck me, and I began to cry. Have any of you experienced that? Same feeling of, it has finally happened. I didn't prepare myself for it. I had never missed it. But when it happened, it was like my shoulders relaxed. It was like putting a blanket around yourself. Finally, it had happened. I'm sure that contributed to my thinking about seminary. Today, first of all, how many of you have had a woman pastor in your experience, in your congregation? Mm-hmm. Okay, quite a few. According to Sojourners, which is an interesting magazine, November 1988, 6.5% of our pastors are women. There are 8,000 now women pastors. Now we're talking about all denominations. Lutherans have about little less than 1,000, ELCA. At Mount Olivet, where I went to be a pastor, was my first call. I was the first woman called, first woman invited, to come to the church, which had an important influence on whether on my decision, because I thought it was really important for a church which already had 7 pastors to have one of them be a female. It was an important thing for people just to see things differently. They didn't have to know me. They didn't have to even know my credentials, just to see a person standing in front of them who was female made a difference for them. I knew that. I was glad that I didn't think about that too much at the beginning. It kind of didn't occur to me until one Easter I had done my part of the worship service, and I suddenly realized, because at Easter, you see, at Mount Olivet's a big church, and we have 8 Easter services, I think it is. And so 15,000 people will go to church that morning. And I was glad that it was all over before I thought to myself, some of these people have never heard a woman before, much in the same way that I had felt that one time. Because I thought, what a pressure that would have been to put on myself about not making a mistake prior to starting. But I didn't happen to think of it till later. One very important part of this process has been language. The language of the church, if you're here, if you're sensitive to what's going on in Holden, is very important. And how we see ourselves and how we image ourselves, it depends very much on our language. Let me tell you a story about a little friend of mine named Colleen. She's big now, but when she was about 5, her mom was praying with her in the evening. That's when I was at Richfield Church. She had, for the last 3 weeks, had some interesting experiences, because one Sunday, a woman pastor who was a child of the congregation had come back and preached, and one Sunday I had preached, and then there was a third one, too, and I can't remember what that was about. And so little Colleen was saying her prayers and God blessing people, and she God blessed Pastor Peterson, Pastor Wayne, she called him. He was her favorite. And after her prayer, her mom said, "You know, Colleen, you could be a woman pastor. You could be a pastor, too," she said. "Oh, no," Colleen said, "I can't do that." "Yes," she said, "you can, just like Betsy and like Judy." "No," she said, "only boys can be pastors." And her mom, who had at one time worked outside the home, mostly was home now, said, "But Colleen, think about how Pastor Domer was there and Judy and so." "No, no," she said, "only boys can be pastors." It made her mom real sad to realize how much it took to break images and stereotypes. And she had, and she was in a kind of a relatively free home in that respect. The same woman who gave communion that time that impressed me so much tells the story about another 5-year-old, something about these 5-year-old kids, who, you know how kids are, especially when you put on that white robe, that alb, kids tend to look at pastors, male pastors, especially if they have a beard, they think they call them Jesus all the time. Have you ever seen that happen? John used to be called Jesus a lot. And this time, Susan, who is a pastor who has red curly hair, real curly, and it's kind of all over, she was shaking hands at the door, and she shook hands with this five-year-old who burst out to her mother and said, "Mom, God has curly hair." Such a wonderful, refreshing experience for her. Back to language. If all our lives we have been told by our language a particular thing, we come to believe it. And we know that about children's self-esteem. I heard a parent calling the child of that family, I'll make up a name, "Oh, here comes terrible Jennifer again." And he did it three or four times, and finally I said, "Pretty soon Jennifer's going to think she's a terrible person." I couldn't resist doing that. Because we do find that what we call people and how we treat them sinks in. Thus, we learned at one time not to say nigger anymore. And with women in language, it is much the same. And over the centuries, of course, we have been called men. It doesn't strange, it doesn't look that way, but we have thought that men was the term that referred to all human beings. And actually, men are a few and far between here, but there are five of you, I think, in this room, and the rest of us are women, six, I see. And the rest of us are women. But because that's the way the language was, and English is a rather cumbersome language, we got used to thinking of man, capital M, referring to all human species. It wasn't so when the Bible was written at all times. The Greek word for man has two meanings. There's the one that refers to all people, anthropologically, and in fact, the word is anthropos, and that word refers to human beings. And then there's the word for males, such as the ones who sit in this room, aner, and that's a different word. And many times when the New Testament was being translated, when they found the word aner, meaning male, they used the word anthropos, meaning, I reversed that. When they found the word anthropos, meaning all people, they used the word aner, meaning male. And so what we got was a lot of pronouns and a lot of words misidentified just by the wrong translation. And in some Bibles are better at having cleared that up than others. I'm grateful now for what we call the Christian People's Lectionary, which is being used by many churches now. And I don't, how many of you use that? You would maybe you don't know, but it looks, it's red. It's about this big, and it's still soft color. Yeah, we know green books and red books in our. And in this case, it's translated by Lutherans and done very well. And it doesn't eliminate all kinds of what we would call sexist language, but it does a good job of making it more human than sexist. And I'm very grateful to that particular lectionary. And you may be using it in your church and not even know it. I'm not sure. However, it helps the little Colleens to understand that she's one of the people too. I can remember, do you recall the time when you had to turn to mother or dad, as a woman particularly, and say, "Well, how come they never talk about women? How come it's always man? What does that mean?" And mother or dad or somebody had to say to you, "Well, it really means all people. It just says man." You know, "Well, this is really my shoulder. It just says arm." those kinds of things are confusing, and it's a long time before we can get through them. And I'm kind of grateful for the time when inclusive language now has come to us. Now, there are disagreements about how much inclusivity we should have and which language we should change. But at least in terms of pronouns and some of those basic things, I think it's very important in shaping who we are and how we feel about ourselves. If you're sort of invisible, and that's what women have been for all these years, because they're never mentioned except as man, if you're invisible, then you don't count for much. That's my opinion. One of the things that comes up in terms of women in ministry is that maybe they don't belong there. that biblically that's not true, that they should not be there. And I have had people come to me and say, I don't believe that women ought to be pastors. Sometimes it hurts. I can remember meeting an old friend, hadn't seen her for many years, member of this same church, knew her when I was a girl. And I thought, she's going to be glad I'm back. And I said, hi, Patty, how are you? Fine. I said, it's fun to be back at Mount Olivet or something nondescript like that. And she said, I don't believe women ought to be pastors. Zip. It was like a knife, you know, in between my ribs. And she doesn't. And she doesn't like it. And I can't explain why she doesn't like it. I have no idea. I have, on the other hand, had some women come to me and say, you know, I didn't think that we should have women in ministry. I remember one in particular, and she said, but I changed my mind. And then she had tears in her eyes, and so did I, because that felt so affirming to me that she had changed her opinion. One of my favorite stories is about a man. He's kind of a gruff guy. He's an old Scot. And I heard about him because one of the other pastors was in visiting with him and made the comment, well, we have two women pastors now, because we do at Mount Olivet. He said, we have two women pastors now. Yes, he said, two women pastors are three too many. So I made sure that I went to visit him the next time I could. And we're real good friends now. It was a long time. It was almost 3.5 years before he would come and hear me preach, though. Even though we had a nice relationship, he would not hear me preach. He would not allow me, quote, the authority of the scriptures that I would be able to interpret for him what scripture was about. He didn't like that. He comes now. I have found that authority is a big issue for many people. We're kind of used to thinking of men as having more authority. Part of that is the size of their voices, I think. And also, that's the way it's been. Men were the teachers, and they were the preachers, and they were the doctors, and they were kind of everything. And we sort of got used to the idea that they knew everything. So did they, I suppose. And it's sort of different to have to trust that someone else knows something about whatever it is. And this goes across the line in any kind of profession. And the church is real slow, frankly, in kind of coming to terms with that. We've had women doctors way longer before we had. And it even goes before then, when we kind of broke up the agrarian society in Victorian times. I think this was the World War did emphasize this. And we said that there would be only one wage earner in the family. Up to then, the whole family had really been the working unit. And we would only pick one, and it would be the male. And that we got into a pattern there that stuck. Can really turn you, yes, it does turn you off.
I'm sure you probably have some
problems. And with everything in this area, affirmative action, for example, always sets us up for that. There will be those who are less competent in any field, but we notice that they're women because women are just coming into the field. We have had incompetent male pastors for years, but we notice the incompetent female pastor as she shows up. Similarly, she may have to be, in some cases, very assertive, or in some cases, aggressive to the point that we don't particularly like it. I think you're right. It would be nice when there are enough that we no longer say that. One of the best things that happened in having the second woman come to Mount Olivet is that she's entirely different from me. I don't know if you could find two pastors who are more different than we are. We're almost the same age, and we both have brown hair. Well, I don't even have brown hair anymore. That's about all we can say. And that's real healthy for the congregation to see that we're not all alike.
Would you please tell me where Mount Olivet is?
Oh, yeah. Good. That's great. Mount Olivet is a church in Minneapolis, but it's a big church. Obviously, we got a lot of pastors. So it's possible for us to have two women and five men. The first Sunday I came, one of the first Sundays I came, I didn't know how it would be to be with these working with these men, who are clearly more hierarchical than I am, because that's what they're used to. And hierarchy doesn't fit real well with the gospel. You know, there's that constant conflict. Hierarchy fits, so to speak, with the law profession because that's the way it's been organized, but not with the gospel so well. And so, and I also knew that we had to have a sense of humor about this thing. Now, the men I work with have been very great. They treat me as a professional, as an equal person. We discuss and argue, and everything is just sort of normal. I don't feel different there. But the first Sunday I knew would be a tense Sunday, and someone gave me an idea. So you remember those hot rollers we used to have? They come in a box. Well, I got out one of these little cosmetic trays, and I put the hot rollers on there, and then I put lipstick and some, I guess, some cologne. I don't know what it was. And brought it into the sacristy. And the only pastor who was there at the time, who I love dearly, kind of just looked at me, you know, and said, "Well, what's that?" And I said, "Well, these are a few things I need to get ready for Sunday morning." And I just put them up on the shelf. "Oh," he said, "that's nice. If you..." And if you knew him, that isn't his style at all. And then when I left, I understand that when I went out to preach at the Home for Our Retarded Children, and afterwards, one of them, now my best friend, of course, said, "Well, I don't know about you, but I get ready at home in the morning." And there was a lot of conversation, and finally one of the wives clued them in that this was all a prank. This was all a joke. But it was great because it diffused a lot of tension that might have existed this first Sunday. That first Sunday, of course, I was exhausted at the end of the day. That was, talk about feeling like you're on the spot. That's what I felt like, 5,000 people coming in and out that day. And just hoping to goodness I wouldn't make a mistake. I find that having a sense of humor is important. I find that choosing battles, as with any kind of thing, is important. You decide what things you want to make an issue out of, and you don't want to make an issue out of everything. Who likes to be around that kind of person? It doesn't work. I think that it's helpful to the men to have me there and to have Kay there now, too, because we give them permission to be more human. They don't have to be as competitive. I was amazed, by the way, those first few weeks at how incredibly competitive they were in their humor. Humor was the way that men did that. We are not a competitive group as a working group, and that I give credit to the senior pastor for not setting that up. However, the way that men work things out is jabbing and with humor. And that was new to me. I was not accustomed to that kind of process. Someone said the other night how glad they were to see the three women do preside at our communion service. And it was Dan Erlander who came over and said, "You know, that was so refreshing. The three of you just sort of shared what you were doing. Did you talk about that?" Well, of course we had never talked about it. We just did that. We just took turns, and we tried to divvy it up sort of equally. He said, "Well, certainly we would have had to establish who was in charge and put him in the middle." I didn't know that. I don't know if that's true even, but that's Dan's perception of what was happening. I think that one of the things that I discover about women in ministry, first of all, we are kind of stereotyped, and I think, in fact, are rather nurturing people. And so a lot of people come to me for counseling that might not have gone to one of the men. That is not always the case. Women are not always nurturing, but ministry is a nurturing kind of service and profession, and so both men and women who are in it tend to be that kind of person. It is nice, I think, to have a woman on staff simply because it's kind of helpful to the women to be able to talk about some of the things, you know, some of our problems we just identify with better. And that would be true for men, too. But we can also cross over, and I think sometimes I can give men permission to hurt, to let themselves hurt, and to allow themselves to have weak moments, if you will, and to be vulnerable. And they aren't so afraid of that in my presence. Now, two women pastors have just walked in the room. You can identify them readily by their collar. Other people may disagree with me, but I do think that one thing that the church has a lot of trouble with is sexuality, period. All of our sexuality. And one of the things that happens to women pastors is I think we get isolated. I have one friend who's a lovely, delightful person, about 35 years old, who refers to herself as the eunuch. A male pastor is someone women will be interested in, because many of us are kind of interested in the power figure or the strong image of the male pastor, besides being a sensitive image. This is kind of everything rolled into one. And if he's good looking, it's all the better. A woman pastor, because of the authority issues, is less desirable in the eyes of many men, much more a threat. I think that's reality. I don't know if the women pastors here will agree or disagree with me. One's married, and so she doesn't have to worry about that or think about that maybe as much. However, I find women pastors saying that as soon as a man finds out what her profession is, that's the end of that conversation or relationship. And I guess I think it's true. Do you think it's true, Carol?
I've been a pastor long enough.
How about you, Joanne?
There are many women pastors who would say, will you stop identifying me as a woman pastor and just call me a pastor? That's what I am.
And that's what happens in the congregation.
And your congregation does that, yeah.
Yeah,
they just call me. This is my own deal. I don't like to be called Pastor Judy. All the other pastors are called Pastor Hansen, Pastor Larson, whatever, you know, and I'm called Pastor Judy. And that says to me I don't have the same... I'm not the same person. Pardon?
Are both women called by their person?
One prefers to be and one doesn't. That's an interesting thing. So then you have two Johnsons.
Pastor Larry and Pastor Rebecca.
Sure.
To distinguish the two.
And there are many congregations where they prefer first names. It's just a matter of consistency that I noticed, I noticed the difference.
Well, first name or all last name, that's okay.
But yeah.
Some are last and some are first, that's not okay.
It didn't feel quite the same. That's right. And, of course, we hear, I mean, this is a horror story of a male-female pastor team having to go to a conference, thus driving X number of miles to some town where they're going to go to this conference, and stopping periodically. Because the pastor seems to have to, the senior pastor, the male, seems to have to make a phone call all the time. He goes in, he makes his phone call, and he comes back. He's having to check in with his wife. She doesn't like it that he's traveling alone with the woman. Those kinds of things sound bizarre, don't they? But they're real. And sexuality is part of that. It's that whole thing about the sexual problems that we have with one person being an authority and the other person not having authority, being the counselee, and we have to be good about those things. We have to understand how those things affect people and understand what it means to have some authority and how to use that appropriately. Now, I wonder, this thing has gone in so many different directions. I will say this, that the decision to go to seminary was a good decision, first of all, as I said, because I began to know more that I needed to know, and finally became, I felt, in relationship in a new way, in my spiritual relationship with God in terms of a forgiven person, and that was happening while I was at seminary, and that was a great thing. I would not have had to go on for ordination, except that preaching was a very important thing for me, and the longer I was there, the more important it also was to be able to give the sacrament. Not because so much that it gave me some sort of special place, but that now it was so much a part of me that not to do that would be empty. Something would be missing for me in my life if I couldn't do that. Being ordained is not the only way to be a minister. And someone kindly said, writing books does it too, you know? And that was nice to hear. But you know, there was some place in my life where that wasn't true, it wasn't enough anymore, that I needed to do something else to express my own sense of faith and call. So not to have been ordained wouldn't have fit. It would have been a real sad loss for me. So that Sunday morning, the afternoon, when I was ordained, was absolutely one of the highest experiences of my life. And I put it right alongside of giving birth to my son, Ted, as absolutely wonderful. And now and scary. Oh, the scary things you say. And now when I'm installing people and having and repeating again those scripture passages that we say as pastors having to do with our sense of responsibility, it's an enormous sense of responsibility. But it is so good to know that that's where I belong. And to feel that this is what I have really been called to do. I got a little late start. But then that means that I also had some other wonderful experiences along the way. And I still have maybe, well, who knows, 15 good years left? We can hope for that anyway. Now, other questions and thoughts that you have. Well, I want to tell one more story. I remember that when I did my internship was the first time I wore that collar. Now, you know, some women hate the collar because it what does it represent? Hierarchy?
Slavery.
Slavery. Mm. Slavery.
It is what it is. It is
the
slave collar.
Is that its history, a slave collar? Oh, my stars. I always have to think about things now. But the first Sunday that I was an intern, then when I was supposed to wear that, I was standing greeting people at the door. And it was interesting how people treated me once I put that on. There were some, these were people I knew now. This is a congregation that I knew well, and so I knew the people, how they responded to me. And there were some people who suddenly began to mother me and saying, "We've just got to have you over for supper someday." Kind of almost patting me on the back. They were used to doing that with male pastors, I think, and so they did the same with me, and some of them suddenly were in awe. You know, these are people I'd called by first name. They'd called me by my first name all along, and suddenly there was sort of like this aura, evidently, that appeared, and they treated me differently. And then there were my friends who came up and gave me a regular old hug, and everything was fine. And then there were girls who were about 12 and 13. And I could tell by the way they looked at me that something new had happened for them. That they had now begun to say to themselves, "Gee, I wonder if I could do that." Which is the question they ask over and over in those years. "I wonder if I could do that or that." And now they began to say, "I wonder, could I be a pastor?" And I love to be able to tell them, "Yes. Maybe you could." That's basically all I have to say.